Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, this is the V-Spot. We're on the air. We are continuing our interview with Miguel Mike Harpo Garza. A few weeks ago, we were talking to him. At the time, it turned out I had a fever during the interview and did not realize it, and I developed a huge lump on my back.
Well,
so
what
for the
did
next
you
several
mean?
I don't know. I was like dying. I can't remember. I went to the doctor. I begged the doctor to cut it open. And the nurses were freaked out by it. The nurses were like, okay, let's see what we got here. Holy fucking shit! Okay, but I think the first question I'd like to ask you here, and I think this is what the rest of the audience would like to know is, where did it all go wrong?
Oh, boy. Well, as I had mentioned, my dad worked in the swimming pool racket. And here in California, where we live in Northern California, it gets hot as hell during the summer. And in the early to mid-80s, it was kind of like a construction boom out here. Everybody was moving to California because that's where all the money was, supposedly. And he was making a killing. He was, during the summer, he was working 60 hours a week. Probably it'd be like close to making like today's world it'd be like making $90,000 a year, and you know, we had this really nice, firmly entrenched middle class family, two cars. Mom stayed home, took care of the kids, and they used the opportunity to start having more kids. And then we had a drought, and when the drought happened, the state of California said, we're going to go ahead and put a halt to all the swimming pool construction. And this was at a time when companies could not keep up with the demand for swimming pools. I mean, there were like, just in the Sacramento area, there were probably 80 different swimming pool construction companies. So, that kind of pumped the brakes on things a little bit, but he'd put some money away and everything was going good. And they said, it's probably only going to last a year. And sure enough, that winter we had record rain levels. So they lifted the moratorium, and then the housing market crashed. So now nobody had equity in their homes, so nobody could afford swimming pools. And so the 80 companies in Sacramento literally turned into four. So you now had all these out-of-work people in the swimming pool trade, and my dad kind of sat me down one day and said, son, things are going to change around here. You know how you play football and baseball, and you have karate lessons, and you have all these other things that you love to do, you get to pick one. And I said, okay. He was a really good baseball player when he was a kid, and he helped out coach our team, so I picked baseball. And then after a while, that became, we actually can't really afford that either. So, how about you just read a lot? And so I started just reading a lot. I kind of grew up reading all of his old Silver Age comic books and stuff. And then slowly it just got to be where he just went from this really happy guy to just kind of like just crushed by life before he was even 30. And then my mom decided to get a job. And isn't that the worst? I mean, it's like, I can't put a price on coming home from school at that age and knowing, hey, my mom's going to be here. If I had a problem at school, she could help me deal with it, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's gone. And at this point, I'm like 8 or 9 years old, and I'm like not really old enough to where I could help out a whole lot. And yet that's kind of what my parents wanted. So it got to the point where I would get home from school and my sisters would all be next door at the neighbor's house, who was my mom's friend who watched them. I wasn't old enough to be a latchkey kid, and that's exactly what I was, because they wanted to save a few bucks and didn't want to pay for that third kid to be babysat. So I'd just go home and sit at home from 2 p.m. till about 5:36, And I watch a lot of TV all by myself and read books by myself. Or, you know, there's kids in the neighborhood that were my friends, but I wasn't allowed to go outside and play with them until my parents got home. So, yeah, I kind of really got cut off socially at a very young age. And it just kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah, you know, I was expecting you to tell me, said, you know, one of our dogs mysteriously disappeared that year.
Never quite got that bad, but, man, there were some dark moments. I started this thing where I would have conversations with myself that I have to, like, I constantly catch myself still doing it at work when I'm out delivering mail. I'm in a truck by myself for 6 hours a day. And there are times where I full-on catch myself arguing with myself out loud and have to, like, look around and make sure no one's watching.
Let me ask you something about the mail. When the mailman says he knocked on your door with the package, do they actually knock on the door, or they just leave a note there saying they did?
Well, if they went through the trouble of leaving the note there, then I would say
it'd be
probably
in the mailbox.
99%.
It'll be in my mailbox. Yeah, it'll be in my mailbox saying, sorry, I missed you. And the thing is, I was in the bedroom, and I didn't hear
anything. Now, see, here's my little thing that I always do. This is just me. I can't speak for everyone else, but if I leave a note at your door, that's 100% undeniable proof that I walked all the way up to your door. And if I walked all the way up to your door, I'm pretty sure I'd take the 10 seconds to knock on it. But, you know, I mean, mail carriers, I can't, like, even begin to describe the level of psychosis that goes on there. I mean, you cannot throw a stick at any post office without hitting at least a functional alcoholic.
Yeah. Actually, I've seen some actual record showings of how people in the post office are. And I believe it's called Postal 2 with Gary Coleman.
That game was awesome.
Yeah,
that's
one of those things. Now, how did you end up working for the post office?
Oh, yeah, it was just another, this is a great story. When my wife and I got engaged, I was working as a handyman at an apartment complex. I think I might have touched on this last time, but it was kind of a weird setup. Originally, my friend had taken the job as the handyman because it came with a free apartment, and he told me, I was like 22 or 23. He said, hey, dude, why don't you just move in with me? We'd had an apartment before when we just turned 18, and it was a disaster. So, you know, we went home for a couple of years, licked our wounds, and tried again. Well, he had found another job, and I really wanted to keep that free apartment. And plus, it was going to work out perfectly because my wife-to-be was moving up here. And I was like, hey, you know, if we have a free apartment, you know, that's going to help save us a lot of money. So the boss at the apartment complex was my friend's sister, who was, how should I put this, a former romantic interest of mine, and it ended really awkwardly. No, this was, she was like, she was the one that I was like kind of in love with all throughout high school when it was convenient for her, and it kind of ended awkwardly, but we, you know, she was still my friend, I suppose, and she still isn't. You know, she's a nice person, and everything worked out for her, and everything worked out for me. So it's like whatever. But all of a sudden, yes, exactly. Now she was my boss, so I actually got used to that, and things were going really good. And then she got transferred to another apartment complex, and they brought in this woman who was a bitch. I mean, it's like I don't use that term as a pejorative very often, but man. This woman was the biggest bitch I have ever met. And within 2 weeks, she had laid me off. It was on Christmas, like 2 days before, it was the day before Festivus, so that's Christmas Eve. And she calls me in the office and lays me off. And I was just like, what? Why? You couldn't wait till after Christmas to do this? And to make things even more awkward, by this point, my fiance had moved up here and had found a job, and they were having their Christmas party that night. So I had to go to their Christmas party, and explain to everyone that, oh, yeah, I just lost my job today. And, yeah, so at this point now it's like I had gone, I don't know, probably like 4 years without, like, you know, reaching any points of depression, and then it was just, like, straight to the bottom. And I had so to get to the post office, it was my grandma had years ago given me the application when I was like 18 and told me I should go work for the rural branch of the post office, just because it was they said it was like quicker advancement, even though it was started out with lower pay. And And I was like, oh, yeah, I don't know. But it said you had to use your own vehicle, and I had a 70 El Camino. So you can't really fit a whole lot of mail in the front of one of those things, and they really don't want you carrying stuff in the back if you don't have a camper shell. So I didn't think delivering mail in a, you know, a car that gets like 12 miles a gallon out on rural highways probably wasn't the best idea. So I ended up not doing that. Well, here, flash forward 4 years later, and I'm, like, literally desperate for anything at this point. I had a guy that I went to church with. His name's not important. I'm trying to think how I can describe this guy. Okay, if you could imagine the human equivalent of a deaf Muppet. Like, yeah, I mean, it's like, I think that would probably be the most accurate way to describe him. He's a really sweet guy. His wife and him were still are friends of mine. He told me that the post office was in desperate need of substitutes, because I guess a whole bunch had just quit.
Yeah.
So this is probably, I'm thinking, by this point I'd already gotten married. This was in, I would say a year after I had gotten fired from the apartment complex. I went back to driving a tow truck for a little while and did some odd jobs for my dad and stuff. And it wasn't really paying the bills. And my wife and I had moved in with a friend of ours that had a empty room in her. She had like a nice big house that she lived in by herself and just really wanted company. So we moved in with her, and this guy Rusty gets me the job at the post office. And, it's just been one continual grind since then. It'll be 10 years on December 1st.
Okay, let me ask you something about you when you got married. Now, when you got her the engagement ring, did you hedge your bets this time?
Did I what?
Did you hedge your bets? You're like, you know, I like her a lot, but I kind of like that last bitch too, so maybe I ought to be a little more careful.
No, you know what? When it comes to matters of the heart, like, I have absolutely zero common sense, but the smartest thing I did this time was I let her pick out the ring so it wasn't a surprise.
I just picture you, like, kind of like clutching to the receipt, though, and you're like, yeah, I guess I can throw this receipt now, like 5 years into the marriage.
Well, it was like, but at this point, we'd been dating for 3.5 years as opposed to 6 months the first time. So,
yeah,
I mean, it was like she stuck with me through 3.5 years of, you know, driving to and from San Jose every weekend and falling asleep in the San Francisco bus terminal when my car broke down, and Greyhound buses where the shitter overflowed in the middle of a trip.
Speaking of last time talking, I don't want to make this big thing, but we were talking about Buzz Sawyer. Have you ever heard the story about Buzz Sawyer and Steve Blackman?
No, I've never heard that one.
Okay, Steve Blackman used to get into fights a lot, like in the late 80s. And I mean, you could tell with him, he's a guy you would not want to fuck with.
Just ask Bradshaw.
Yeah, you don't want to mess with him anyway. Okay, so Blackman keeps getting in a fight. He's getting arrested. Finally, his girlfriend at the time told him and gave an ultimatum that if he got into one more fight, it's almost like a cartoon, that she was going to break up with him. And I guess he loved her, though it's hard to picture Steve Blackman loving anyone, but he goes on a tour with New Japan, and this is like 1989. Buzz Sawyer and Vader are there. And both Sawyer and Vader keep fucking with him, and because Blackman doesn't fight back the first time, they think that he's a soft touch.
Yeah, that's the green light.
Yeah, so they keep fucking with it. Finally, at the end of the tour, Blackman went broke up with his girlfriend. He broke up with her. After that, he tried to get booked on a show with Buzz Sawyer again, and he could never meet him again. And he said he was so broken up when Buzz Sawyer died because he said he wanted to beat the fuck out of him.
See, so, there's certain things you can't let pass.
Yeah, okay, so we get to 97. Blackman's like this. He hears WWF's at a show. Raw is. Raw's going to be their life. Blackman decides he's going to go kick the shit out of Vader. This is 1997. This is 7 years after this. It's still on his mind. And I understand this. As a psycho, I understand these thoughts. He gets there, and he's getting ready to beat up Vader. Vader approaches him, shakes his hand. He said, "Yo, I'm really sorry about how I treated you." Vader has no idea what Blackman had planned. He just felt bad about it. And Blackman was like, "Well, shit, now I can't do nothing." And that's how I am. I've had these things where I'm about ready to get in a fight with somebody, and I'm getting ready to go punch them, and they apologize to me.
Yeah, dude, that's the worst, is being disarmed by kindness.
Yeah, it's like,
kept me
shit,
from having a broken nose about a couple of times from him.
Yeah, I got ready. I'd be so pissed at Dill. It's like, all right, I'm sorry, Victor. Oh, fuck.
Man, why do you got to be nice about this?
Yeah, well, my dad said, no, my dad used to do that, you know, because I'd get into fights with him, you know, or really bad arguments. You know, because he got to an argument with my sister one time, you know, and I told him, fuck off, leave her alone. You know, I mean, they weren't fighting or anything, but he was talking to her really bad. You know? And, you know, I told you about my dead drunk daddy. You know what I mean? And I get ready to call him, and I'm like, well, I'm gonna cuss that old fucker out. You know, and I get the phone, and he answers. He says, "Hey, son, how are you?" I was like, oh, God damn it.
Yeah, it's my biological dad and I, there's been a couple of times where he'd been messed up, and I kind of, like, threw him around the apartment to try to sober him up a little bit. But my stepdad who raised me, we had one physical confrontation, and he's a small guy. He's, like, maybe 150 pounds, but he was always really strong just from doing swimming pool construction all day. So up until about age 16, I didn't think I could take him. By then, I'd been wrestling for a few years, and I was like, you know, maybe now's the time. And he had this thing where it was like he wanted the house, like, spotless when he got home. And I'm 16, and, you know, TV's on, and I've got homework, and there's video games, and there's four other kids in the house that could help. So I kind of started shirking on my chores a little bit, and we had this thing where I don't know why we ever thought this would work. We would not do anything until we heard his truck pull up, and then we'd run around the house and see if we can clean the whole house in that 30 seconds it took him to walk up the driveway. Never quite worked out. So yeah, exactly. So we had, like, this sink full of dishes, and it was my day to do the dishes, and I hear the truck pull up, and I go, oh, shit. So I'm running down the hallway, and I didn't make it. And he's, like, yelling and screaming at me, and I get over to the sink, and I start washing the dishes, and he comes up, and he grabs me from the back, from behind around my neck. And it's kind of like Mac on It's Always Sunny. Somebody touches me from behind, I just instantly, just boom, just with the elbow. Elbowed him, knocked him back a little bit. He comes running at me, and the only thing that I can grab is a broomstick, and I grab it, and I just Pete Rose, like, just nice level swing as hard as I could, and snapped it in half across his head, and he kind of, like, staggered back a little bit. He was like, I don't think it hurt him. It was just more, he was confused, because I had always kind of, whenever he, like, would get mad about something, I would just instantly kowtow to him. It was, like, the first time I displayed backbone, and it was so confusing to him. And after that, you know, it never happened again.
Well, the thing was, when I was a kid, you know, I was 6 feet tall by the time I was in fifth grade.
Oh, jeez.
Or sixth grade. I was bigger than my teachers. I was bigger than my parents. But the thing about it is, I was kind of passive. You know, I would, you know, I basically, if an adult told me to do something, I just went by what they said. But, you know, my dad, he's being belligerent one day, and he said he's going to whip me for something. And again, I can't remember what it was. I might have deserved it with him. I doubt it. If Mama was mad at me about something, there might be validity to it. The thing
yeah,
I learned as a kid, most things with adults are power plays with kids. If it's not running in the road or something, it's usually the adult trying to do a power play because they know you're getting bigger.
Yeah, well, definitely true.
Yeah, so he told me, to, he said, all right, boy, you're going to go to the I stand up. And you know the part in Back to the Future 2 when Griff stands up with his bionics?
And he's, like, way taller.
Yeah, that's what happened to me when I stood up, because Daddy used to be tall, but then he broke his back in the 70s. And he had, like, two back surgeries. Yeah, I mean, he should have been dead well before 2004. But, you know, he just looked at me and said, boy, we're going to have to work something else out.
I used to run whenever my mom would want to spank me. It got to the point where she would have to, like, sneak attack me, like, just preemptively spank me for something she thought I might end up doing.
I'm kind of like a cartoon lummox in the way you could hit me from behind and things, and I'm not really going to feel it. I'm kind of like Moose from Archie Comics.
I read Bo Jackson's autobiography when I was a kid, and it said, like, he did the same thing. He would run from his mom whenever she'd spank him, and then one day she's standing at the front door with her belt in one hand and a Colt 45 in the other. She said, you go ahead and run. I got something that could catch you now.
I was actually watching his, you know, he's an amazing, you know, I watched the, you know, because we're watching those ESPN documentaries.
Yeah, the 30
and
for 30.
And those have such a mixed success rate because there's just as good a chance they're going to be fucking terrible.
Yeah, it depends on the filmmaker because, I mean, I've seen, like, some, like, the one about the two Pablos, like, about Brazilian soccer. I don't give two shits about soccer, which I know is sacrilege for a Hispanic person to say, but I absolutely have never enjoyed soccer. And the whole thing is in Spanish, or maybe it was in Portuguese, I don't even remember. It was in a language I'm not entirely comfortable with, and I sat there and watched the entire thing, and it was gripping.
Yeah. No, well, I like watching a lot of stuff about sports. I mean, because when I was a kid, I actually did like sports. You know, I keep up football because I'm big and fat, so I have to play football.
I can't imagine that in Alabama.
Yeah, so I'd be playing football. So, of course, I'd always get to, you know, and the problem was I was antisocial and I was poor, so, you know, and that shit costs money.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd watch football and I'd watch baseball. But the thing about football in Alabama, and Neil could back me up on this, the 90s, after a certain point, Alabama just keeps breaking your fucking heart. And both football and life. And you have to stop caring, because I'll tell you, when they started winning a couple of years ago, you basically, for two seasons, I was like, those losers will fuck it up. Still, do you remember when we were at Kroger 2 days after they lost to Florida, and we saw Alabama take some discount? Yeah, it was right the day after.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But, yeah, so I used to watch those, but I've been watching some of these, and the Bo Jackson one was really good. I like the Miami Hurricanes one because they did not mention when Alabama beat the shit out of them at the Sugar Bowl.
Oh, man, there's that one where they left out a ton of stuff. They, like, left out, like, literally, if you had watched that and had not known anything about college football, you would have thought there was, like, a 10-year period where the Miami Hurricanes never lost.
Yeah, I know. And, like, in the losses they did have, they try to give an asterisk to. And the Alabama one, I can't believe, because that was such a famous game, especially down here, because, you know, I could remember that game being such a huge deal down here, because the thing about college football, and I try to explain to people this, why college sports are so important down here, we don't have a lot. You know, like, you've got NASA, and that's good for the middle-class people and the engineer families, but if you're poor down here, we don't have pro sports. You know what I mean? We don't get concerts a lot. but we've got football.
You got Bear Bryant, man. You got the spirit of
right.
Bear Bryant. That's a
right, and there's a pride in thinking we. Oh, and okay, while you're here, can you tell me the story about Shawn Michaels' wrestling school that you heard about? Because you told me the story about when Shawn Michaels fired Jose.
I meant to tell you, I really can't. I mean, I can give you a couple of stories, but my friend who I got the stories from actually has a show on Blog Talk Radio and is a promoter, so I really don't want to get him into too much hot water. But just suffice it to say, Michael Shane, or Maverick Matt Bentley, as he later became known, is a fucking asshole.
Was he actually related to Shawn?
Yeah, okay, I'll tell this story. The very first day of, at the Shawn Michaels Academy, they have a thing where it's like, the first day that you're there, you go and, it's just like wrestling, you go and you shake everybody's hands. And, Matt Bentley comes in, doesn't shake anybody's hands, and he's just kind of sitting around, stretching out, warming up. And they had a thing where they warmed up, they ran around the block there, wherever the gym was, and the last person in had to go run it again. And so as they're stretching out, Shawn comes in and he's talking to Rudy Gonzalez, who is his head trainer, and he keeps saying something like, yeah, there's some asshole kid who's using my name around this area, says he's my nephew or some shit, blah, blah, blah. And Matt Bentley raises his hand and goes, yeah, dude, that's me. I'm Matt Bentley. I'm your second cousin. And it turned out it actually was his second cousin that he just had no recollection of.
Oh, God damn. Just like the old second
and,
cousin.
Matt Bentley finished last that day when they ran around, so he had to run it twice. But that was just the tip of the iceberg with that guy.
Did you ever hear the story about how they almost did an ECW back in 2000? They almost did a Shawn Michaels Sandman feud.
Yeah, isn't that when first they wanted him to come in and manage Just Incredible, and Vince said no.
Right.
And then, yeah,
well,
I remember
that.
He was
trying to get his students booked. He was trying to get his students booked. And they were actually
going
to do some
Shawn
Sandman.
Yeah. Oh, he had a bunch of these guys who did dark matches. Yeah. He had a guy named Ruben Cruz who did dark matches, and they were ready to sign him. ECW was flat out ready to sign him, and he quit. He just retired.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like I saw this video WWF did about Jesse Ventura, and, you know, Gorilla Monsoon saw that. He said that life as a wrestler was so difficult that unless you really loved it, he said you weren't going to last. You just quit because they can't pay you enough.
Yep.
But,
and that's the thing. Sean's first class that he had was Danielson. I'm trying to think who else. Lance Cade.
Kendrick.
Shooter Schultz. Yeah, no, Kendrick was the second class. London was second class. I'm trying to think. But, I mean, he had, like, a good, you know, dozen guys from that first class who at the very least got developmental deals.
Yeah. Well, you know, Trevor Murdoch told a good story about Shawn Michaels. You know, and again, some people try to make Shawn Michaels, he was an asshole back in the 90s. They try to make him sound like he's some type of monster, which it sounds to me like he's just a guy that was on drugs, you know, and nobody'd really correct him. But there's some cool stories about him later on, you know, and they said at one point Lance Cage, Trevor Murdoch were getting pissed off. They were about ready to go tell off Vince, and they were going to his office, and Shawn pulled him aside and said, hey, you idiot. If you hold off right now, they're about to have you do a program with the Hardy Boys, so just shut up.
He knows because he did the same thing.
Yeah, or there's a story, I don't know if you read his book, but he saw it when he was running that promotion in school, and he said running that promotion, he made him feel bad about how he treated Vince, because he said running a Rinky Dink indie promotion gave him such a headache. Because guys be saying, you know, I don't like where my spot is or how I'm being booked, you know, and Shawn said he couldn't help but thinking, you know, I've made a vintage WrestleManias and you're trying to tell me this shit.
Yeah, no, that was a good book. That was a really weird time for him because it was like before he got totally clean, but he wasn't on the road, so his drug use kind of leveled out.
He was functioning.
So,
yeah, he was functional.
Yeah, you would get like, and my friend was telling me, he said like he would be sitting there, and he, like, part of his thing when he retired was, you know, not, don't get in the ring, don't do anything, blah, blah, blah. So he would have Rudy do most of the teaching, but Rudy would kind of fuck things up every once in a while. So Sean would go, no, you do it this way. And he would get in the ring and, like, snap suplex a guy and then kip up. And everyone would just be looking at it like, holy shit, did he just do that? And then, you know, he would, like, kind of think about it. He'd think about it for a minute, start rubbing his back, and then go sit back on his chair.
Well, my feeling was always it's probably more cumulative than it was anything.
Yeah, oh, yeah. A smaller guy like that having to take huge bumps for all those years, it's going to add up.
Yeah, because, you know, and people try to say, oh, well, he was getting a lot of money every week, you know, not to work. But here's the thing about it. You know how much money he could have made in 98 if he was wrestling regularly?
Oh, yeah. If he'd gotten out of his contract and gotten to WCW, you know what they would have done with him?
Yeah, I mean, they gave him a shit ton of money, you know, and he'd have been safe just because he'd had that. He wouldn't have got treated like Bret Hart did. You know,
I probably wouldn't have taken it.
Yeah, I thought Bret's problem was that he kind of went into places, and people say that he would play politics. I always got the feeling that he would just kind of try to do his work and just be done with it. Because I always got the feeling he didn't really, I was talking to a friend of mine, you know, Dylan Waco from one of the boards we were talking about. He said Bret seemed like a guy, one of those old school guys that would work in a factory where he didn't really love his job, but he took a lot of pride in it.
Yep.
You know, he worked hard, but that was, and like I said, I'm not really as mad about what happened at that show because I found out that's kind of the racket that's being run right now, and I feel like Brett would probably feel bad if he knew what a miserable time I had trying to meet him.
Yeah, I'm sure he would.
All right, so, yeah, it's like I said, because, you know, listening to him, you know, he's an interesting guy, and I'm just glad that he's got that shit behind him because I watched that DVD he had back in 05, and that is the most depressing person I've ever seen. He looked like a guy that was sitting around waiting to die.
Oh, God. The one where Vince starts out at the beginning thanking him for being the bigger man.
Yeah, he just... And now you get fast forward a couple of years, and Bret's having fun. He just talks about shit. He's just, you know, he's enjoying life.
Did I ever tell you a story about when I went and got his autograph when his book came out?
Oh, no.
Oh, God, he did a book signing here. That was, like, right around that same time, like, probably, like, a year or two after that DVD set had come out. And so I brought my DVD of that. I had the DVD set. I bought the book, and then I had a VHS copy of of Wrestling with Shadows. And so I was, like, maybe, like, the sixth or fifth, because the Borders books was right by my post office. So I stopped in there right after I got off of work, and they said, yeah, he's going to be here in about an hour. There was, like, maybe 15 people in line. And I was like, oh, man, this is so sad. So I went and got in line. And seriously, by the time he got there, the line went out the door and around the corner and wrapped around the building.
Yeah,
I was like, holy shit. So I got the autograph, and he, you know, talked to me for a couple minutes, and he was a really cool guy, but it was just like when he walked out, he was so gaunt. And, like just, like, no color, his hair, like, he hadn't colored it in a while. And he just looked like life had just, like, just pistol-whipped him or something.
Yeah,
but
just,
he did, like, this, he did some really cool artwork on the box of the of Wrestling with Shadows on the picture of Vince. He, like, X'd out his eyes and then wrote, like, Satan on his forehead.
Yeah, and Jesus, and, you know, and I'll tell you the part on the DVD, because I'm watching it right now. They got the part where he was talking about Owen, and God, and I mean, you could tell he blamed himself for Owen being dead.
Yeah, it's like, it wasn't his fault, but it's like, what's
he doing? It was just a freak accident.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, I mean, you know,
I mean, it was totally preventable, that's the thing.
Yeah, which I remember, let me get back to you, because, again, we got distracted talking about other stuff. It's one of those things where
it's good, though. Wrestling pulls me out of depression. That's good.
It is. It's like, and I'll tell you something, because they kind of handled me and you trading depressing stories, because I'll tell you, anybody that sees me on Facebook or anything, if my mood swings, I'll tell you something, you're only seeing, and you can ask Neil this, you're seeing 5%.
Oh, I'm sure, dude. That's not indicative of the real you. Next time you have one of those news things, I'm just going to start posting YouTube videos on your wall.
I'm doing okay at the moment, you know, it's like, but I can't predict them anymore. I had a dream last night, I got a full scholarship to Columbia University, and I feel like it's my brain, I feel like my subconscious was telling me something about going to school, because it's the only thing I haven't tried. You know, so I'm probably gonna go try to get my GED and then try to go get a Pell Grant or some shit.
There you go.
You know, because it's like I'm already poor. So you know, that's the good thing about being poor is it's a financial suit of armor. You know, I mean, you know, you can't put me in debt. I pay my bills, but you can't do shit to me. What are you gonna do? Yeah, I got to a fight with a dude, you know, a couple months ago. Somebody pulled a knife on me a couple months ago, and I swear to God, I started laughing at him, and I told him if he didn't stab me, he was a fucking pussy. I don't give a fuck. So anyway, in the category of other wrestlers that me and you have killed, Bison Smith.
Oh, God, dude. I felt really bad about that one, because that's a guy who never even made it.
I know, and the thing is, he was pretty good. I've seen some matches with him, you know. It was like he's a guy that if WCW was still around, they would have signed him.
Oh, yeah, he would have been like the prototypical power plant guy.
Yeah, they would have signed him and put him on the roster somewhere. That was great. We're actually at the Death Valley Driver Board, which I'm still at because I've kind of burned my bridges everywhere else.
Yeah, I signed back up there, too.
I got banned from the CKC Kaiju board. Do you know how hard that is?
I think banned people is like three.
Right. Do you know how hard it is to get them to drop their I don't care dude mannerisms?
It's like getting a nun to cut.
Yeah, I'm very proud of that. And I'm glad I was banned for it, because, again, that place, if you're in a kind of mentally dark mood, that's not the best place to be.
Yeah, I think it was just created out of angst. And the people that still post there now, it's relatively mellow. But, yeah, I mean, it's like, for the most part, we're all Facebook friends now, or Twitter friends. So
right.
It's kind of irrelevant.
Yeah, Cox tried to get me to come back one time. Under a pseudonym.
Yeah.
And he said he would lift my IP ban, and the thing about it was, my exact words were, why should I hide? They're the ones that suck.
And to be fair,
I remember
really
I had
only one person.
Yeah. I had a list of demands. I can't remember where they were, but I had a big list of demands. Number one, I have to be made the sole administrator of the forum. This is non-negotiable. Number two, A.B. Murray is to be taken into the middle of the forum and executed. This is non-negotiable. I can't remember what they were, but it was enough things where it was like, you know, it was kind of like what Sabu said about doing barbed wire matches on indie shows. He said his asking price was $10,000 more than you want to pay. And this is what I do for other things. I'll just give such a ridiculous... I used to do this in school to teachers. You know, I would just make these ridiculous demands, you know, and they really couldn't do much. They put me in detention or something, and they didn't realize that from the age of 12, I didn't give a shit. That's probably my biggest problem is that I don't know why it is. It's probably... I'm kind of like Ned Flanders in the post office, but for some reason I always fight authority, and there's like no reason. They're perfectly nice. I just won't listen.
Oh, no, we all get there.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, comparing fictional male postal workers, who is your hero among fictional postal workers?
Physically, it'd probably be Newman, but... like, as terms of, like, my wealth of useless knowledge and, at times, complete and total alcohol problem, I gotta say, Cliff Clavin. I mean, he is the prototypical postal worker because he drinks a lot. He's socially awkward, and he knows a ton of useless shit that is not at all applicable to real life.
Do you remember the episode of Frasier they did, and this was his last appearance, where he, and I mean, I watched this just because it is like such, it's a dark episode of television. Cliff is retiring. He's moving to Florida. They set up a party for him, you know, and poor George Wendt came in, and he gained so much weight since those days, it looked painful to see him walk. And I'm not making fun
of
him.
I hated Frasier, but I'll check that one out.
Yeah, just check it out. Okay, so Carla is ecstatic that he's retiring. And she set up everything, you know, to send him off. And I can't remember what happened, but Frasier told everybody they should make a bigger fuss about it, that it would probably hurt Cliff's feelings if they didn't. So they made a bigger fuss, and at the end of it, Cliff's like, oh, well, you know, you guys made such a big deal about me leaving. I'm going to stay. And Carla grabs a sword and tries to stab him.
They actually have now regulations for uniformed postal workers. They cannot go to a bar in their uniform after work because
of
Chris Klavan. They call it the Klavan rule.
Do you remember the episode of The Critic when they showed footage of Hitler and they had the slackers and they said, hey, look, the mailman from Cheers.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like Cliff Klavan in many ways is my spirit animal. I mean, it's like, if we have a downtime at work, somebody has like a box of trivia cards from some board game, and they'll pull them out, and I swear to God, I know 99% of the answers, and it gets to the point to where it gets annoying, like to my coworkers, so they just stop doing it. But I mean, it's like I could totally see myself like having that golden opportunity, like Cliff did when he went on Jeopardy. And then completely blowing it, but trying to, like, back out of it.
That's what happens to me. I freeze up when I actually need it. The weird thing is, the subject I only know a little bit about, I can bullshit you for probably an hour. Like, I can bullshit somebody about pro football. I can bullshit my way through it, and I haven't watched a full game in, like, a decade. Or boxing. I can... Oh, did you see, because we only got 2 minutes left, I just want to mention, did you see where Rick Bowe tried to go into Muay Thai fighting?
Oh, no.
He kept lifting his leg, and it's like he didn't realize he was going to kick the other leg. How did he not see kickboxing?
Bo Holyfield 1 and 2 are like two of the seminal moments of my childhood.
All right, go ahead and tell me about it. You might get cut off, though.
Okay, well, my friend across the street had a black box that allowed us to watch all illegal cable. And so we're over there, we're watching Bo Holyfield 1, which is where the fan man with the parachute thing lands in the ring. And
yeah.
We're, like, going crazy. It's just like, holy shit, I can't believe this is happening. And Holyfield goes on, wins the fight, and then the rematch, after, like, 5 or 6 of the rounds, they would continue just throwing haymakers at each other after the bell rings, and it was just like, that was the last time boxing was good.
Yeah, I just can't believe all these boxers that have never seen Kickboxer. Or even Danny Alexio, Dennis Alexio, he never saw Kickboxer, then he got his ass kicked in a Muay Thai fight.
Do you remember when Riddick Bowe tried to go in the Marines and washed out after like 2 weeks?
No, I did. I feel bad for the guy. And now he's saying he's wanting to go into pro wrestling.
Oh, God. He's got to be pushing 50.
Yeah, well, these guys will see it, and some of these guys think, oh, it's going to be easy, and they don't realize, you know, you're probably going to be taking more hits in wrestling than you would in other sports, because in wrestling, the hits are unavoidable.
Yeah, you know, and you're going to definitely get concussed now. I mean, you're not going to even get
right.
punchy. You're going to get a full-on concussion.
All right, man. They're going to cut us off. It's a lot of fun. We'll try to finish up with some Secret Origin stuff next time.
All right, man.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.